Ready.
Okay. The Kofsky, so Kofsky gets disappointed. Do you have that on record, him saying that in his reviews of later Zappa?
I don't. I'm kind of thinking about Henry Cow in Britain and Carl Dallas, who represented like some of the most interesting radical musicians and critics within the British scene, and their rejection of Zappa after Flo and Eddie. I'm thinking of that more than specifically Frank Kofsky.
Yeah, I just know that Frank Kofsky is never seen again in association with Zappa. He just disappears. But the interesting thing, you talk about Zappa moving into the Freudian zone, it was in the early 70s, according to a book called The French Joyce by, I think, Gert Lerneau. He documents how, after 68, Derrida and the Joycians start retrieving Freud. And this is the interesting thing about Zappa. He was so tuned in, and Gail has commented on this, that even though he's doing his own work and moving on, he is registering, and you can find other areas of culture that are moving in the same direction. So his move into Freud, or echoes of that, the Freudian unconscious, was being done by other people that were very involved in the radical mood of the 68 period. So just an interesting parallel I've thought about, and it's the first time I've had a chance to say it.
I have my objections to that, Bob. I got a lot of objections to that, Bob, because, I mean, when you think about surrealism, which kind of undergirds a lot of what, well, Zappa and Derrida and all those people are doing, they were part of Freud being first translated into French, I mean, coming out of German into French. So the idea of going, I mean, we can have an idea of some sort of pendulum that swings between Marx and Freud, and you could say, well, that's like swinging between self and society. Freud deals with the self, Marx deals with society, so people go from one to the other. Though I think if you examine either of them, you'll find that they're trying to talk about the other thing through Freud talks about the psyche and the self, and is always trying to talk about society, and Marx actually is all about alienation and the experience of the self within society. So dividing it like that always seems to me a partial understanding, and the pendulum swinging between partial understandings, it seems to me these are the times of fashion moving from one thing to another. And I think, Bob, you and me should be beyond this. We are not interested in Derrida's star rising and falling and so on. I mean, we can explain it, you know, that after the disappointments of 1968 and the fact that this fantastic world revolution didn't seem to win, a lot of people like said, let's bin Marx, let's bin Freud. I mean, they wanted to get away from all thinking. We invented postmodernism. But I think true thinking should stand back a bit and with a certain kind of aristocratic disdain from this fashionable pendulum swinging.
Oh,
yeah?
No,
do you see what I mean?
I understand that. No, I sort of agree with Jane. I didn't mean that. I'm just saying that Gert Lerneau noted that in their early 70s, Telos magazine, I think it was Telos, T-E-L-O-S, that Derrida and his other people sort of dropped their Maoism and went into Freud.
That's like dropping the worst kind of Marxism you could ever adopt. I mean, you know, the.
No, I agree. I'm not talking about the quality. I'm just saying that here's Zappa.
Other
area moving in that direction. Mm. But the postmodernists end up writing histories and saying, well, the great Derrida went into Zappa.
Well, I'm worrying now that you're putting Zappa in the same breath, that Zappa is not critical but in the flow, and then we can follow it actually probably better with the Beatles, and we say, well, 1968 is the summer of love, and then 1969 we get into violence in the streets, and then we can track it all with Beatles. We don't even need Zappa anymore because we can track it with the Beatles.
No, but you're, wait a minute. Zappa is nothing but, in his albums, not in his concerts, but in his albums, commenting on the trends and fads.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
I'm not saying that Zappa went into the Freud at the same time because of Derrida or anything else, though we could look at McLuhan, who might be able to explain why that became a figure for a few years in the early 70s for intellectual concern among people who were radicalized. I'm just saying that I'm trying to show that Zappa was tuned in, and to be a figure, to be someone who's commenting, you have to be sensitive to what's happening. And today, or back in the 70s and 80s, everybody was sensitive. More and more people were being addicted or worried what was happening on the media, and they'd spend a lot of time watching the media. That is a problem for the revolution here.
Uh-huh.
But Zappa was very good. I've heard people say, you know, by the late 90s, that, gee, I wish Frank was around to comment on the .com web world. You know what I mean? They miss his critique of the of the 90s.
The beauty of it is that I think it's immediately apparent. I mean, what somebody once said to me, among a group of friends, there's always one of them that likes Zappa. You know, there's a group of friends, and some of them into Van Morrison, and some of them listen to Bono, and there's always one who likes Frank Zappa. But I always think that one is the most critical and thoughtful person of the bunch. And it's this ability to always produce the objections, to not go along with fashion, to criticize fashion, which means that, for me, Frank Zappa is in the media world a prosthesis of a coherent revolutionary attitude, that they should be connected. Unfortunately, a lot of the people who are into revolution specialize in that and just can't see that it matters to have some record that people play at parties which kind of objects to a lot of things and gives a chance for the 1/20th person who objects to assert what they think. But I think it's crucial.
Yes, now, in your...
Tell me, I spoke quite a long time then. Is my voice cracking up at your end? Because your voice is getting very bad.
Oh, no, you're clear.
Okay. Well, that's all right. I'll just talk more for this half.
Yeah, you can and see what I can get in. I wanted to say that it seems in the Marx world that you're in, or the Socialist Workers' Party world, or whatever it is over there, that you're always bugging these people, say, hey, don't specialize. I've had the same effect in the McLuhan world, in that people think, they don't see where Zappa or all these other things I bring up, Lina LaRouche or something, has to do with the McLuhan world. So we're both non-specialists, and I'm saying in a totally, okay, today, what is a revolutionary attitude, and other than we're celebrating things that people don't normally celebrate, and we get on the air and bug people because we do that. That's not a revolution unless it's... Are you just worrying about an attitude, having a revolution attitude? I know you want to get rid of capitalism, but how do we juggle that? Or are you having a good time while you're on a serious agenda to overthrow capitalism?
Well, I didn't quite get everything you're saying there. I mean, I think that a certain kind of depressive, profound left-wing pessimism about the world is a completely reactionary point of view. The point of view that says, well, you and me, we agree about our values, but there's this bad world out there, isn't it awful? That in fact, that particular point of view always destroys any kind of life and proper revolutionary spirit. And that the duty of a revolutionary is to take absolute joy in the fact that the whole thing is disintegrating.
Okay, just so if we broadcast this, and I don't even know if I'm coming through clearly, if we broadcast this, the fact that I'm breaking up is part of our jamming, because I'll get to say what I'm saying now later when it's a better connection. And the reason the connection is good today is that we're using my computer rather than Carolyn's. Carolyn's has a stronger Skype for some reason.
Well, it's a question I'd like to ask you, because I'm using Esther's computer, my partner's computer. Why is it that women today have the better computers than the blokes?
Because they know what they're doing. we're just old POBs trying to keep up.
Right, okay. So this is Amateur Hour. We're the clowns. We're following on the big procession. Did you know that in ancient Rome, when a successful... Caesar come back from conquering some outlying parts, so they could take the captured men in the you know, that they defeated and send them to the other side of the empire to do work and with slaves and so on, and come back and they'd do a big procession through Rome, and everyone would shower him with petals. Always in right at the end of the procession, there was a donkey pulling some foul-smelling cart with a guy standing up just making fun of everybody. I think that's who we are.
Yes, yeah. You mean there's the Manipian?
Yeah. Manipian. Yes, Manipian.
Now, the thing is, we're not specialists, so we watch our partners become specialists and get addicted to the latest medium, and they become experts on it, which, if it's an archetype, women have the opportunity this century to do this, to get into technologies that they couldn't have 50, 100 years ago, right?
So, but
they are pushing us into computer dominance. Anybody who's using an expert at the computer world is inflicting it on us, and not definitely not warning us of the side effects of what they're doing, and that's part of our revolution. I'm on another show, and I broadcast every week, but today I announced that it's no longer an ongoing press conference. I announced that I was president of the United States, and it's going to be a State of the Union address. It's going to go on indefinitely, and that is a practical response to this media swill that's going on all over the place.
Well, I walked into my house, my flat today, and for some reason the TV was on, and it was Gordon Brown, our Prime Minister, doing a speech at your Congress. He's been over there in the States. I mean, I know you're in Maui, but you're really part of America. And I felt before I walked into the room, there's some acting going on. There's some ham acting, and I hate actors. I hate that. I like rock and roll. I like people who get up on stage and provoke an audience and are real. I just, the idea of acting, you know, I'm going to act Jim Morrison, I'm going to act someone else, so why not be yourself? What's going on? And I just felt there's someone acting. Who is this great ham? And I went up, and it's my Prime Minister. I mean, you know, it's just, and I mean, I think most people know that, you know. I mean, you know, most people hate politicians, don't they? But they don't know how to get rid of them.
Ah, that's the problem here. We're potential politicians, and yes, that's our issue.
Well, I think we're actual politicians on the level of Frank Zappa or George Clinton or the people I like in the, who I've found who have some sort of influence on this electronic world that we're dealing in. And they're people who didn't stand on their dignity and weren't, they had nothing to fear from people revealing anything, because they're not standing on some moral card which doesn't admit all the truths which Freud found out about everybody, that we're not standing on any plinth of lies, of a pretense about what we are. And this may make us silly or disgusting or what have you, but we think most people are pretty silly and disgusting, but also brilliant, and we should work from there, you know, and this level of excellence where, I mean, so much politics is about being able to undermine somebody for something which, when you think about it, is not really a bad thing anyway. I don't really understand it. I mean, I find it hard to comprehend. I mean, do you comprehend it, the kind of ways in which big figures are brought down?
Yes, I comprehend it. I mean, Cohen explained that in his book From Clay to Archetype. But, you know, since, am I breaking up?
Yeah, you are, you are. How do you know you are?
No, I don't know. I had to ask
you. You can hear it in my responses to you.
No, you're clear.
All right, well, if we keep going for another 15 minutes, we've still made a show, so maybe we should soldier on under these difficult circumstances.
Yeah, like I'm Cecil Taylor, you know, I'm Wildman Fisher. You know?
Yeah, well, Cecil Taylor insists on the very best piano, and he makes you wait, you know, in queues, you know, while the piano's changed, because it's got to be one with, you know, two extra notes on it.
Yes, have you ever heard, years ago, in 1970, I thought I read that Zappa named Moon Unit after Cecil Taylor's album Unit Structures. Have you ever seen that?
I have read that as well.
I can't find it anymore. I don't know where he said it.
We'll have to go and ask Gamma. He has one of the better archives.
Oh, okay, because later it's Moon Unit. I think he has other reasons. Tweezle was named supposedly after Gale's toe, big toe.
Yeah.
Anyways, it never came up again. He said it once and he never reiterated. He should have been saying it when he was on Johnny Carson, you know, because everybody always asked him about the names.
Well, in naming children, parents enter into the level of poetry, because in naming children, you become aware of all the repercussions of a word. And every parent becomes a poet insofar as they name their children, and they become aware that they can't quite control all of the possible meanings of the names that they give their children. And as their children grow up, other things are discovered about the name and about associations to do with the name, and the person develops, and the whole thing has a life of its own. Now, this is something poets know exists in every word, but I think all parents are poets when it comes to the names of their children, don't you think?
Yes, it makes self-conscious about the medium, and they study the effects only because they personally are going to be identified with it. We're going to be judged by it.
It's all true. But this is also why Finnegan's Wake is so nominalistic. Finnegan's Wake, if you look at it, it sometimes just feels like a list of names. Everything is a name. I mean, I think Joyce does this because in making up a name, you can say anything you like, any sound you like, because when you introduce to somebody and they have a name, you can't say, well, your name is not this, is not that. You have to put up with their name, particularly in an international context. I mean, living in London, you're continually hit with the most extraordinary syllables and sequences of words in people's names. And I think Finnegan's Wake was predicting this kind of internationalization. But I think there's also a thing in Finnegan's Wake, and it relates to poetry and Zappa, and I hope you will help explain this back to me, which is why the listing of names is so important in Finnegan's Wake. There's a reason why Joyce felt that he had to keep creating ridiculous names. I mean, it's just all over it. It's just like what the book consists of in many ways.
Yeah, a key line in Finnegan's Wake is, who gave you that name? But it's spelled N-U-M-B. Who gave you that numb? Who gave you that name? That's a key line that McLuhan used to point out, because any technologies and speech and naming is technology, it numbs you. It changes your sensory ratios. Now, I was going to say, just a step back a bit. When I read the art class in Cleavage, you talk about the nominalist tradition. And you kind of describe it, and I need to have you say your definition in a minute. You describe it in terms that McLuhan says are the non-nominalist tradition.
Well, that's good.
The rhetorical grammarian tradition.
Well,
and it's interesting. So what is nominalism aware of the categories, effects of names, in your understanding of nominalism?
Well, it would do, because the way I understand nominalism, and I thought I would agree with McLuhan, because he's quite a medievalist. I mean, he understands the Middle Ages, and probably that's why he remained a Roman Catholic.
Partly true.
And in terms of medieval philosophy, there was a long-term dispute within medieval philosophy between realism and nominalism. And in nominalism, people felt that reality was the specific things that are. And in realism, they were Platonists. They believed that the real things are the abstract forms which persist through time. And so a nominalist would say, I only believe in real circles which are drawn here, there and everywhere. Whereas the realist would say, no, the real circle is something abstract which is ineffable, that you can never get your hands on, but is the idea of the circle. And that's more real than any particular circle that might be written. So the nominalists were always on the side of the particular and didn't agree with generalizations or abstractions. So in that way, a nominalist is kind of close to a materialist.
Right. But isn't one of the definitions of nominalism is that they regard naming as arbitrary, and you could name anything, any name you want, whereas the grammarian says, no, the object evokes the qualities of the kind of name you need.
Well, when we get into linguistics and naming, then I'm prepared to... I mean, these big generalizations about disputes and philosophy in the Middle Ages kind of break down, and I would not like to... I mean, I feel suddenly disqualified to assert about that.
Okay, now all through your books, you point out that the thing described is not the thing. How do you say it? The conception of the thing is not, it does not include all that the object is.
The quote from Adorno that I use a lot is, the concept does not exhaust the thing conceived.
Yeah, okay, that, in a way, okay, if nominalism doesn't put too much value on the name and says you can name anything, it's the object or the reality yourself that you're naming is more important. Is that included in that definition you just gave?
Well, it always depends upon which levels people point to, doesn't it? Because you can be a materialist of the kind that says, well, the concepts that you have and the words that you have doesn't exhaust real life. Real life outflanks you. And I kind of would like to be that kind of materialist. But then you can also have a materialist who says, well, the real thing is the words people say and their actions and the ways in which we communicate. This level you're talking about drops away. I don't understand it because it doesn't matter. I'm a real materialist because I'm talking about what people really say. And so it's almost like you can point to different levels and assert a materialism at different levels. So it does very much depend upon the particular context in which somebody is trying to be very material.
Okay. I'll leave that lying. And
I suppose for me, the sublime argument, or the argument I love, is the one that tries to keep all the levels in the brain and to make you aware of all the levels, so that the kind of chauvinism of a particular level and playing one off against another reduces, because you are imagining all the different levels that you can, and so that you understand that we're on, you know, a ball of magma that was thrown into space from the sun and all these physical things, and you understand it all the way up through society to the very high level of us talking to each other, and that none of these are specified as not interacting with each other, but there are differences between them, and that you try and understand them all in their interconnectedness, so that the whole thing is combined yet uneven.
Yeah, and so I immediately think of the trivium. McLuhan said if he had a day in modern education, he would have the kids learn the rhetorical tradition, the grammarian tradition, and the dialectical, plus the quadrivium, which is music, arithmetic, geometry, and astronomy.
Well, these are classical divisions, aren't they?
Yes, and so he believed that, you know, you use all the modalities.
Mm.
So,
but I think they need to. I think they need to interpenetrate. That I would be quite suspicious of someone teaching Latin that wasn't aware of the Earth's crust and earthquakes and Vesuvius and how the divisions in the Earth's crust and volcanoes affected the Romans. I mean, that all these things interact, and you can't really, by looking at any particular thing in proper detail and proper alignment of where it is, it does unfold to be everything. And that anybody who really concentrates on whatever their subject is, it all turns inside out, and they find they have to know about everything else. That no subjects are ends in themselves, that they become little keyholes through which you suddenly see everything.
Right, you're quoting McLuhan again. That's exactly his approach. And Marx felt that too?
Well, I'd be hard put to it to find a quote where Marx says exactly that. I feel that Marxism is the carrying into secular society, into a Darwinian rational secular society, hermetic ideas of the one and the importance of understanding the one, of understanding the totality, and that he maintained that in looking at economic issues which divide society from each other. So Marx always had an idea of, yeah, well, it's okay to teach this about how to compete with another firm, but what if all the firms compete? Can't you try and imagine the whole society? So by maintaining this idea of totality, which comes from dialectics and from hermetic traditions, within a non-religious age, it seems to me he's providing the key argument to criticise the disastrous outcome of rationalities pursuing each other in ways that aren't trying to imagine the whole or the whole thing.
Yes, and that's what Finnegan's Wake tries to do. So Joyce and Finnegan's Wake, includes the Marxist mandate, as you just defined it. But the thing about the list of names, and we must be coming near the end, right?
We are, yeah. Yeah.
We've got about a minute. I just want to say the list of names.
No, we have another 5 minutes or so.
Oh, okay. He's listing...
Oh, no, we're 55 minutes, aren't we? We've only got another minute. You're right. Sorry.
Yeah. The listing of names is one aspect that the eye is molded by in the book, but at the same time, every page is condensed like little holograms, which is like Zappa's pinheads, all crammed into one sentence, one page. He's showing more than modality on the book page. But the listing is maybe the normal human mind, but then all these other effects are coming in from media or something, from relations of capitalism, that are causing an implosion. So definitely listing must be done all the way through the book, but the canceling of listening is also always maintained throughout the whole book of Finnegan's Wake.
And the end result can only be understood sonically or musically?
Perhaps.
For another show.
Let's go on to just do that next session if we remember.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's talk again, Bob, and this is the end of this one. Cheers.
Thank you, Ben.